You guys ready to do this?
Welcome to the Cap Space Wins Cups podcast.
Brown ahead for Murray. Murray going in. He scores!
He will play. You know he'll play. He'll play on crutches. He will play. And he'll play at Madison Square Garden.
Morrison scores! Brendan Morrison, a silencer!
To Daniel, coming up front, Hendrick scores! Hendrick from Daniel! Canucks win in four overtimes! Cutting in, shoots, scores! They've slayed the Dragon!
Double overtime, and the Vancouver Canucks are going to the Stanley Cup Final!
They are simply put, the two greatest Canucks of all time. Please welcome Daniel and Hendrick Sedin.
Elias Pettersson put it into sport mode!
With Hughes ahead, here's a break. It's Bo Hornman. Beagle to stick. Scores! Game winner for the captain. Scores! Chris Tanev from the point has a series winner for Vancouver.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cap Space Wins Cups Podcast, episode 80 on the Area 51 Sports Network. I am your host, Hassan Ahmed. I am not joined by my usual wingman and ace and host. It's just me, Andy, today. Andy, what's going on, man?
Not too much. I'm just glad that some of us make time for the podcast.
I know, right? I did have a dock your pay last week, so sorry about that. But don't worry, host and ace will be also docked for this week's missing.
That's right. Exactly.
We are on Zoom, so we apologize if the audio quality is not the best. Obviously, producer Ace not available today. The standards have really slipped around here. It took us 40 minutes to get this set up.
I was going to say, if they saw the trouble we went through to get it done, they'd understand.
They would. Ace probably would have freaked out before that. So we're just glad we can still put out an episode this week. We only had a couple of games since we last recorded, not with Andy, but since the last episode came out. Obviously, Canucks starting a 7-game homestand here. We're recording on Saturday today. They're coming off a overtime loss to the Washington Capitals, but they did defeat the Montreal Canadiens 5-3 in the first game of that homestand. 5 games to go here. 1-0-1 start. I think the Canucks will take that for now. What do you think of the homestand so far, Andy?
Yeah, so far, so good. I mean, the Montreal game, I think they were clearly the better team. I think they were kind of, I don't want to say unlucky, but I think they outplayed Montreal for large stretches of that game and for whatever reason couldn't score. Yesterday versus Washington, I mean, you know, they got a point considering they were down 2-0 going into the third. That's pretty good. However, they did, you know, lose. They had the lead and they blew it at the end. So,
yeah.
You know, overall, not too bad, but, you know, when you kind of dig a bit deeper, they probably should be 2-0, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough with the Washington game. Like you said, they obviously stormed all the way back in the third period. They always look like a new team in the third based on how the first two periods had gone for that game. I mean, I know a lot of people were pretty upset with the officiating, but the Canucks had their chances. Besser obviously draws a penalty with 2 minutes left in the third, just over 2 minutes left in the third. That was a golden opportunity for the Canucks to kind of put the game away. Washington goes back to their way and, still makes a game of it. But I think I'll be pretty happy with the effort overall. A lot of the players were kind of echoing the same sentiment. Horvat had a kind of interesting comment talking about, or sorry, Quinn Hughes had an interesting comment about how it's becoming unacceptable to lose and in the dressing room and that, you know, that's the pushback in the room. I definitely liked seeing that for sure. I think you'll take the point in a non-conference game, but, the Canucks, it was really disappointing to me in the first period because every time I feel like this team's had a chance to get back in the playoff race and really cement their chance and being like, hey, you know, put us 1 point or 2 points out, they've kind of come out with a really, really flat effort. I'm thinking of the Anaheim game. I'm thinking of the Islanders game. I'm thinking of the Devils game on the last road trip. And you had an opportunity against Washington to put yourself 2 points out of the playoff spot with a game at hand on Vegas, and you come out with a pretty dreadful effort. What do you make of that? What's this been why is this happening with the team? Clearly they're better than that, but they come out with these flat efforts and these really key games.
Yeah, it's weird because it's been a problem the the entire year, right? Like even going back to the Travis Green, like, you know, how many games do we see where it's 3-0, 10 minutes in and it's already over, right? So I don't know, like if it's, I don't know. I, you know, they're professionals. You assume they show up to the rink ready to play. So I don't know if it's the coaching deployment, if they just need to play the best players more at the beginning of the game, or if they play them less, or I don't know, but it is weird. And it, you know, like we said, it's cost the team games before. Like I think of Anaheim, you know, I think that game, if they won, they were in the playoffs and they were down 4-0 at the end of the first period. Right. So, something needs to change. I don't really know the answer to what to change or why it's happening, but I don't know. I just feel like anytime you're down 3-0, you're probably not going to win that game. And if you do, you have to be happy just getting a point out of it. So something's got to change, and it's got to change quick, because I feel like if the rest of the way, if they're down 4-0 in the first period, it's over.
I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. It's like, I think Demko last night really kept him in the game for stretches of it. Like the fact that we're able to get into the third period only down 2 goals makes it seem a lot more attainable. But, you know, we've seen this similar effort, like you said, right, where the game is out of reach by the third or fourth, the third period, you know, where they're down 3 to 4 goals. And then you're like, okay, it's a lot easier to play with a 3-goal lead, you know, than it is with the 1 or 2-goal lead. Like the other team's loose, they're locking it down. So I think Canucks kind of owe Demko the point there. But I did want to kind of talk about like the pushback we've seen from this team recently. Under Boudreau, they have gone down in certain games. Like they've gone down really big, obviously. But there have been other games where the Canucks surrender the first goal and they don't seem like, oh, the game is over. Because I remember, you know, at the beginning of this season with Travis Green, it seemed like if the other team scored first, the game was over. Like you might as well turn the TV off. You know, the Canucks are going to win this one.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. It's I do like the pushback, and I just find they don't feel like defeated, right? Like I felt under Green, if anything went wrong, they kind of threw their hands up in the air and said, all right, well, we'll get them next time. It's just, you know, whatever. Right. And now like I think it, like you mentioned earlier, it was Quinn Hughes who said, you know, after the game versus Washington, the standard is winning. Like anything less than 2 points is completely unacceptable to us. And that's a nice change, because I don't remember the last time we heard a Canucks player say that. I mean, sure, they might have said it, you know, a few years ago, but, you know, realistically, when you have Jason being on your first line, is that, you know, that's like me saying, you know, if I don't make $10 million this year, it's unacceptable. Well, I don't have a job that pays me that much, so I don't know how, you know, like, it's not going to work that way, right?
It's just lip service. Like, how many times have we heard people say, you know, this is unacceptable, this is unacceptable? If we just keep standing around here saying everything's unacceptable, but we keep going out and losing every game, is it really unacceptable because there's nothing actually happening? Right.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, you know, even those games, like I think against, was it the Islanders? They were down 4-0, like 8 minutes into the game, and nobody did anything. They just kind of looked around and were like, all right, well, I guess it's 5-0. So we'll try to win again. There's no pushback.
And then you see that kind of stuff. But then a week and a half later, you're playing the Devils and the same thing happens. And you're like, these efforts aren't acceptable. Well, what was it different a week and a half ago when we did the same thing on home ice?
Yeah, exactly. Like that was the weirdest part about that Anaheim, New York thing. It was like 9 days apart.
Yeah.
And they were down, you know, a combined score of like 9-0, 10 minutes into the game.
It's honestly so strange. Like I really cannot figure out what the relation is with these. It's not like they're playing against these world beating teams either. You know, it's like the Islanders having a tough year. The Ducks are probably worse than the Canucks now. You know, the Devils, like, mostly non-playoff teams, and it's like coming out with these flat efforts. It's kind of inexplicable if you think about it. That was the difference last night, though, when you saw that, you know, you can say it's unacceptable now, but you stormed back with 3 unanswered in the third to put yourself in a position to win that game. You know, there was maybe some questionable officiating if you want to go down that road or whatever, but you gave yourself a chance to win that game. And then if you come out after and say that it's unacceptable, then you can at least see, hey, you know, there was some goddamn pushback when the game was on the line. We didn't just roll over to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And like you said, I don't know why this is happening, but clearly there's something going on, right? It hasn't been like a, you know, a one-off or a two-off. It's been under two different coaches, and it's happened consistently for 60 games know.
Yep.
So I don't know, but it's weird. Like, because you look at the roster on paper and you see, you know, they're not the best team, but they're also not a team that should be down 5-0, you know, every third game.
Yep. Yep. For sure. Like, this is not the Coyotes or the Canadiens here.
Yeah, exactly.
I did want to ask you about the kind of line. I know yesterday we saw like a big change in the lines in the going to the third period, which kind of rallied the comeback. I'm not sure if there's any long-term fit there, but we did see Miller and Pettersson get reunited, and we saw Besser and Horvat get back together. What do you make of the lines? You think that maybe there's something there in a long-term fit? For me personally, I love seeing Miller and Pettersson get back together. I think that their line was making a lot of plays happen, and I did not think Chiasson or Pettersson is going to be the answer. So I do think that Miller and Pettersson do need to get back on the same line at some point here, and because their chemistry is undeniable, you know, and I think it made a huge difference in last night's game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever want to see Chiasson play on the Canucks ever again, but especially with Pettersson. You know, to me, that like I agree with you. I like Miller and Pettersson together, but the problem is then the Canucks only have three centers because Dickinson is in the center. You know, we haven't seen Sheldon Dries or Sheldon Rempel or DiGiuseppe's a winger, but he hasn't played a game yet either. So, you know, if you kind of look at the 12, 13 bodies they've had, like, then you only have three centers. So I think, you know, what they did and pair them up for the third period, Miller and Pettersson, is good because you can basically just roll three lines anyways. But I don't think it's a long term start to finish, rest of the year, every game scenario.
Besser and Horvat, anything there you like that Horvat obviously?
I mean, I don't know. Like, Besser and Horvat, to me, they're two of the, I don't want to say slower players, but they don't have any blazing speed, right? So, you know, it makes it tough. I think you, if you're going to play those two together, you need a super fast player on their wing.
Tanner Pearson, perhaps. I said Tanner Pearson, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. Speed winner, Tanner Pearson. I mean, like, I don't know. Besser and Horvat, I didn't find they were super dangerous 5-on-5 yesterday. They did a lot of damage on the power play, right? So, personally, I don't really see the fit, but it's not something I'm going to complain about either.
Yeah, I mean, I like I said, it's really frustrating because I'd really love seeing Miller and Pettersson together. But like you said, I think that the way the Canucks are kind of constructed right now, like, Dickinson has been a huge failure, swing and a miss. So Miller pretty much has to play center. Like, cool, there's really no other options. You can bump. I mean, I guess there's a world in which you, like, Highmore, Lamico, Mott are deployed as a, more of a third line anyway. This, you know, they're written fourth on the depth chart, but they play a significant amount of minutes on the team. And Lamico is really impressive this season, so maybe you can be, maybe he can be third line center. But then if you kind of stack up your top six, that's gonna leave you with, I mean, in Boudreau's world, probably Hoglander, Podkolzin, and like insert player here as like a fourth line that's gonna play like 8 minutes a night, and I don't think that's the best thing for either of those players.
Yeah, I don't think that's really the way to go. I think, you know, you kind of have to ride it out, sort of like they did last night, the rest of the season, and put Miller and Pettersson together towards the back half of games, and in the off season, you need to find a legitimate third line center. Easier said than done. They tried with Dickinson. It clearly didn't work. But, you know, I don't think you can, this team is good enough to play Miller and Pettersson apart the whole season and be a playoff team.
I just, cause the thing about if you get the lotto line back together and you just try to scrap the rest of it together, the Canucks are really going to be a one-line team.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's going to be tough to win with, although the only success the Canucks have had over the past 8 years was on the backs of one line together, really. So,
yeah, I mean, like, you know, it can be done. Like, I look at Calgary and they're not really a one line team, but they have a ton of, you know,
they have like three third lines and one first line.
Yeah, exactly. Well, same with Boston, right? Yeah. Like the Pastrnak, Bergeron, Marchand line, and then they just kind of have some parts that chip in, right? But, you know, I don't know. Like, that's the one worry I have about Calgary to make a playoff run is that, yeah, they got to Foley, but I think they can use one more legitimate forward. You know, and that's a challenge for the Canucks, right? If you have one good line, then you probably need to add another two or three good forwards to balance everything out.
Yep.
And, the cap probably won't allow you to.
Yep. I mean, it's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place at this point. I guess, I think, like you said, the best world is probably the one that we're living in right now in terms of those Horvat, Pettersson, Miller playing center and then kind of finding an okay mate. Kind of, I guess, I think I'm okay with kind of sliding their wingers around. And, you know, if Besser and Pettersson work together with Miller for a few games, go with it. If it runs dry and, you know, I don't know, Pod Colson and Garland are now working with Miller, like, fuck it, use that. Like, whatever is working at the time, just go with it. I think the Canucks have a lot of wingers that are kind of, they have a few wingers who kind of have a similar skill set. So if something is working, just go with it for now.
Yeah, like, you know, I never understood this obsession that the market has with having three lines that play 79 games together.
Yeah.
You know, you can change it up. If, like you said, if something's not working, then move players around and fine. At the end of the day, they're all NHL players. They're all good players. Like, you know, I don't recommend putting Juho Lamico and Pettersson and Besser together, but, you know,
maybe it works.
They can play with Dickinson. They can play with Pearson. Yeah. Like, it shouldn't be this difficult.
For sure. The Dickinson conversation we've obviously had a few times in this podcast. This kind of brings a thought to my mind about, you know, the right mix of players in a team, because Dickinson was a guy that, you know, you look at his player, Jay Fresh analytics, and his player card, and you think, hey, like, this seems like that perfect kind of player to come into the Canucks. Third line center matchup guy, takes a load off of Horvat. I would say probably, like, you know, 75% of the fan base was pretty happy with the Jason Dickinson acquisition. But you see him play and you're like, it's just not the fit there. And it's kind of hard to tell those things before you get a guy in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Calgary this year, and they've picked it, like, Zadorov and Goodbranson as a third pair. You know, terrible analytics players that we call Eric Goodbranson, like, not an NHL caliber player when he was in Vancouver, and he went to a few other places before he got to Calgary, and they were, you know, thinking the same thing, that this guy can't play in the NHL. Calgary's kind of found some use for that and had to throw back on a third pair. They're kind of, maybe they're not the best at moving the puck, but they do something out there. I think sometimes analytics make it hard for you to, like, differentiate player type, because just because a player is effective doesn't mean the player type might be the best fit for your team. You look at a guy like Garland as well. His analytics are through the roof. I think he's like he's a high 90s percentile for most of his categories. But, you know, he hasn't really found the level of success his underlying profile would suggest. And I think that comes down to player type as well, because the Canucks have not a lot of players like Garland. But you look at Hoglander, Podkolzin, and Besser. You know, there's four or five guys competing for that same role in ice time, and it gets complicated. So I really think that maybe I wouldn't be such a slave to, like, analytics on that front when I'm looking for players, because you can find players who maybe have a shitty underlying profile but bring an element to your team that you don't necessarily have. I'm not saying you should be, you know, going out overpaying for these players. You know, you can find, you know, Gutty and Zadorov for, you know, league minimums, and they're giving you effective third pair minutes. But maybe the Canucks do need to change something up like that, because when I look at the Canucks forward group as a whole, it is like a lot. It's like a big mush of all similar player types to me. Kind of slow guys who have some skill. You know, they're not all exactly the same level of talent, but you understand what I'm saying. None of them are really fast. Got a couple guys with some great shots, got a couple playmakers, but all kind of in that same mold. They don't really stand out in that way. So all of your three lines have kind of the exact same look when they're attacking you, which makes you a lot easier to defend.
Yeah, for sure, right? And, like, to, you know, it's all about stylistic fit and how you use them, right? Like, in my opinion, Dickinson hasn't worked out because, number one, he can't take a face off.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, I don't find he has enough speed to make a third line with Pearson or Garland or whoever effective, right? Because you kind of have, you know, three guys who aren't slow but aren't really fast either, right? And, you know, touch on your comment about Goodbranson and Zadorov. The reason those guys work is because they're not asked to do more than they're capable of, right? They play 10, 12 minutes a night. They're asked to hit, go off the glass out to center ice and get out of their zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Luke Shannon and Quinn Hughes.
Yeah.
The reason Luke Shannon works is because Hughes skates the puck, does all the skating and puck moving. Shen just hits people and flips the puck cross ice to Hughes or goes off the glass to center. Like, he's not trying to be Quinn Hughes. right? And I think the problem with the Canucks forwards is, like you said, they have six guys who, you know, they have decent shots. They're not really playmakers and they're not really super fast. So what's the difference between the six of those players? And the answer is basically nothing. So then how do you fit, you know, you can't fit half your lineup playing the exact same way and make it work. Like you need guys like, you know, Tyler Mott, for example. The reason Tyler Mott's so effective is because he's so fast. Like, you know, the Lamico line works because they dump it in Mott's corner. Mott races in there, gets the puck, and then he, you know, he's able to pass it to Lamico or Highmore. And same thing with Highmore. Highmore is super quick. And Lamico's a good fit there because he realizes that he doesn't need to be the first guy into the corner to get the pucks. He can let the wingers get it, and he just needs to get open for a pass.
Those are three guys that have different player types than the Canucks generally have. Lamico's a huge body, and he's hard on his stick, and he goes to the front of net. He's not trying to do too much. You know, he's not trying to dangle people. He gets a puck, and he shoots it on goal, and then that's something, you know. I would say he's got pretty nice hands in tight for a fourth liner, for sure. You know, he's got some, you know, okay work around the net. You know, we saw him try to go between the legs last night as well. And then, like you said, Highmore and Mott stand out so much. And, you know, this market's ready to throw the bank at Mott because he's the one player on the team who's got a skill set that the rest of forward group, and like including the entire top six, doesn't have. He skates his ass off, and he can actually get to, he's often the first guy to the puck. I'm not saying that all your players have to be that way. You don't have to be fast to be a successful NHL player. You know, Miller's leading the team in points, goals, and assists, and, you know, he's definitely not the fastest player, but he has other ways to make himself effective. But if you have three guys who are trying to do the same thing as Miller all the time, it's probably not going to work, because I can probably only afford one, maybe two guys who carry the puck over the blue line constantly and then throw by blind backhand passes cross ice and then somehow have it work. I don't think that, you know, it's a strategy that I necessarily want all my players to be doing all the time.
Well, exactly. I mean, they've already tried Miller with Horvat at the beginning of the year, I think, and it didn't really work that great because, like you just mentioned, both of those guys like to skate with the puck through center and sort of drive the net and use their body and their shot to score goals. Well, you know, if Horvat's doing that and Miller's just falling behind him trying to do the same thing, like, now you're basically playing 4-on-5.
Yep. And the really frustrating thing to me in terms of stylistic fits is, like, mostly the Canucks have nothing. Like, the Canucks have an assortment of players. But two guys who really fit well together are Pettersson and Besser. Like, their play styles, like, you know, you're outside looking in. Like, you don't really know too much about hockey. Like, hey, this guy is an elite playmaker, great hands, high hockey IQ. This guy also, great hockey IQ. And he's a sniper. He's got a great shot. One's lefty, one's righty, one's center, one's a winger. You know? This should work. Those are two player types that generally, if you look around the NHL, you know, Ovechkin has his Backstrom, you know, everyone, those kind of players generally work well together, Gensel and Crosby. So why aren't Pettersson and Besser back together at this point? And if you're going to trade Brock Besser, don't you at least owe it to yourself to see one last time, like, was Pettersson and Besser's chemistry just a flash in the pan? Or was that something sustainable that you can have? Because if Pettersson, your best player, has long-term chemistry with a 24-year-old right-shot winger, I feel like that's a guy maybe we shouldn't be dumping out of the market when he's on a terrible QO with a terrible QO, and you're going to get cents on the dollar for him?
Yeah, like, I agree. I think you need to give Besser an opportunity to prove that he can play with Pettersson or play with Horvat. I think, you know, we already discussed Horvat isn't necessarily the best fit, but, you know, if Pettersson and Besser could fit well together, then yeah, I don't know why you'd want to sell low on Besser. So, you know, it's tough because the Canucks are just close enough to the playoffs where they feel like they need to make a run for it. And unfortunately, that means not putting Pettersson and Besser together. I think in an ideal situation, if they were 5 points further out, you would just say Pettersson and Besser, you guys are together. You get 18 minutes a night, you know, do what you can do, and then you can really get an idea. But for me personally, I still think, like you mentioned, the Backstrom, Ovechkin, the Pettersson, Besser, you know, Crosby, Gensel, there's still a fit there with Besser. I think Besser's smart enough to realize that he doesn't need to skate the puck through the middle of the ice into the offensive zone. He can let Pettersson do that, and he just needs to get open for a shot. So I'd be very hesitant to move Besser right now, especially when you consider you're going to be selling low.
Yep.
But Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's tough because we haven't seen them play together. And if you're going to commit long-term to Besser and Pettersson, ideally, I think you'd want those guys to be able to play together.
I think, like, if you really want to trade Besser, I seriously think you could probably convince Besser to sign a contract for a six-year or five-year term underneath his QO. And then if it's really not working out and, you know, maybe you bring in Miller back if you found some other way to move money and it's still not working, then maybe you can move Besser. Then his value is going to be a lot higher with a contract in hand than it is going in with this QO and uncertainty. And the thing about Besser is, like, I can, from a fan's perspective, I can really see why he frustrates a lot of people. You know, he really tries to make a lot of plays up high sometimes. I don't really know if his hands are that good, but he tries to do that kind of up high deke a lot. I think, you know, if you play him in the right situation with a guy like Pettersson, just get him the puck, and Besser is just really got to simplify his game. Work hard on the boards, be a good two-way player, be smart in your own zone, get the puck to guys like Pettersson who can make some space, get open, and when you get the puck, just fucking shoot it. You have the best shot on the team, and, you know, pretty much all the best scorers in the NHL, who's made this point, if you expect, you know, you look at Matthews, Ovechkin, Dreisaitl, you look at these guys by the end of the night, you know, they have 10, 11 shot attempts on net, you know, 10, 11 shot attempts, you know, five or six on net, and those are guys scoring 40 goals. Besser probably has the shot and the high-end skill to score 40, because I'll be honest, there's not that many 40 goal scorers in the NHL who score all their goals in front of the net and in tight. You generally need to have that high-end release that, you know, you can beat a goalie clean, like where he's you're staring down the key goalie and you can beat him with a clean shot. And Besser's one of the few players in the NHL that has that ability. So it's frustrating you don't see him use it all the time.
Yeah, it's very frustrating because, like you said, he, to my opinion, has a top 10 shot in the NHL. Like, I'll never forget, I think it was his rookie year, maybe, he beat Carey Price on the top of the circle clean. Price was set, he came out, and Besser just beat him clean. Mm-hmm. You know, there's maybe five guys in the league that could have done that. So, yeah, it's frustrating Besser isn't using a shot. And, you know, I think when Boudreau first took over, you know, Besser was that guy who would get like 17 shot attempts in a game. You know, it has slipped a little bit right now lately, but I do think that, like you mentioned, that's the path for Besser being successful. If you try 12 shot attempts a game and get seven on net, like, you're going to score 35, 40 goals.
Yep. And that's the thing about Besser was, like, in his rookie season, okay, every score, it seemed like every time the guy scored was, oh, power play, he's in the slot, wide open, look, clanks the wrister, loads it up, and then lets it fly, and then just repeat, and then put that on loop, you know, 29 times. But, you know, obviously, you're not going to stay in the NHL with one thing, you know, I'm not constantly going to be open, having all the time in the world to just unload a wrist shot. You know, teams are going to close up, be like, hey, you know, let's watch out for number six, the guy's got a good shot. And I definitely noticed, especially in the 1920 season, an evolution of Besser in terms of he was kind of diversifying his game. He was becoming a much better two-way player. He was scoring goals from in front of the net. You know, like we saw against Montreal, like where he was kind of jamming the puck in from the side. He still has a great finish in tight. So those are good things that you want to complement in that game. Like, that's a great way because you don't want teams to constantly be just worrying about one thing about you. And I saw that, so I kind of understood some growing pains there. But I feel like, okay, like, you figured it out now. You can score from a few different places on the ice. But, you know, we know where your bread and butter is, and I think you do too. So I just don't understand why it can't be like, hey, I'm putting you the best playmaking guy. You're going to ride here 15, 20 games. You know, like, earn your money, man. Like, this is a contract year for you. You want that? You want 7.5 on a long-term deal? Like, if you go hot, Besser has 13 goals in 30 games under Boudreau. There's still about 22 games left here. Like, Besser's a guy you can score. He could score 12, 13 more in that time. You put up a half goal per game pace, and I don't even think that's too crazy if the team wants to make the playoffs for Besser. Like, if I'm Boudreau, that's what I'm putting that opportunity in front of him right now. I'd be like, hey, you know, you want a contract? I'm going to put you with Pettersson. Like, go there and shoot the damn puck.
Yeah, I agree. But like I said, I don't think the Canucks have the ability to wait for Pettersson and Besser to figure out their chemistry again. Mm-hmm. You know, they've kind of found something here. Obviously, a lot of it has been power play, but they found some scoring 5-on-5 as well. And I just don't think they have an appetite to move away from that and potentially lose games and miss the playoffs because of it.
That's true. But I mean, like, If I was Boudreaux, I'd be like, I'm pretty confident that these two can figure it out. And if it's really not working, I'd be like, okay, maybe we got to mail it in. And it's not that the Canucks don't have a lack of options. Miller has been the Canucks' best skater for most of the season. And you're not going to be leaving him with spare parts, right? You'd still have Hoglander, you still have Garland, you still have Podkolzin. Pearson has had a great year, in my opinion. You know, there's still enough there that you can take the burden off some of those guys. And Horvat's obviously going to be relied on for chipping in some offense. So that's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see Pedersen and Besser play together. Like we mentioned, I think they're probably the best long-term fit for this organization. However, I don't think that's going to happen outside of the power play or outside of, you know, things going really south with, you know, a game or even a stretch of games where they're not scoring. The Canucks have found something here, and I don't see them changing it when they're close to the playoffs simply because they're winning games.
Yeah, I mean, if you're right. If it's working, why would you go away from it for now? And like you said, nothing's going to stop you from changing the lines in the middle of a game where, you know, where it's a little bit of a dry spell. Obviously, last night, Horvat stepped up big time to kind of lead the team back in the charge. Boudreaux had some comments after the game where he said that the one of the captains delivered the speech, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, between the second and third period to kind of rally the troops before going out to the ice for the third. And he said one of the captains. And then Luke Shen revealed that Miller was the player who spoke up in the dressing room. Obviously, this I put out a tweet talking about this, got a lot of reaction on that. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this so-called leadership rift in the market. Sakaris obviously reported that potentially Horvat and Miller didn't get along. To be honest, I feel like since then, I don't know if this is on purpose, but Horvat and Miller seem to kind of lean into that a lot more. And you see them in videos, and they're sitting next to each other in the dressing room, and they kind of seem like they chat a lot more. They celebrate pretty, you know, when Horvat has the two goal, the tying goal there, you can see Miller and him are both getting, you know, pretty excited for each other. But I don't know what this notion is. Like, I heard this from Carson Price the other day as well, where they're talking about, you know, Miller. They want Miller to be the man on the team. They should clear the decks for him. Like, why would Miller be challenged by Horvat? Like, I don't understand why you can't just have two guys on your team who are good leaders and can fit the team well. Like, do you really think Miller gives a shit who's the captain, who's the alternate captain? Like, it's not like Miller doesn't wear a letter on the Canucks.
Well, exactly. Like, I've never understood this idea that you need to have one leader, one captain. Like, all the good teams have multiple leaders, multiple captains. Just because Horvat doesn't want to stand up and scream at players in between, you know, intermissions or games, doesn't mean he's not a good leader. Like, at the end of the day, I don't think the players are really concerned with who has a letter on their jersey and who doesn't. Like, you know, the leaders are going to lead the team. And I find that the captain, that kind of stuff is more for PR and the fans and sort of, you know, outside sources, I guess you could say, outside factors. And, you know, if JT Miller wants to be the guy who stands up and yells at the team and gets them ready to play, then who cares? Like, I don't understand why that's bad.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also weird because it's like, It's usually a leadership group, like you said, you know, so it always helps to have more than one guy who's in there making a difference. And I kind of understand some people, you know, they always say that, you know, Miller is the best player on the team. So when he steps up to say something, maybe people are more likely to listen because, hey, you can see this guy is the guy, you know, scoring every night. Horvat has obviously had tough stretches throughout the season, but Horvat is like a pretty consistent player. He's 20 goals for the fifth time in his career. And he's constantly, you know, 50 to 60 point, 20 to 25 goal guy. He comes to work, gives the same effort. He's consistent, professional. I don't understand why players wouldn't listen to him. And like, you don't have to be the best player on the team to be the captain. You Colorado, Landeskog is the captain, not McKinnon. McKinnon is clearly the better player of those two. But I don't think that makes Landeskog any less of a leader or captain of the team. And it's just weird because I don't know why people expect it's like a Horvat versus Miller thing in terms of they're comparing their play. Like, who cares if JT Miller is scoring more points than Bo Horvat right now? Horvat is a bona fide top six player on most teams in the NHL. He puts up a reasonable number. And, you know, if you score 50 to 55 points, that is clearly, you know, that's easily second line production, like borderline first line production. And, you know, if you score that many points, you know, you're going to have stretches of games where you're 55 points is not a point per game. You're going to have stretches where you don't score. 20 goal scorers don't score every game. They score once every five games, which is around the pace Horvat scores at. So I just don't understand the general – I don't understand what the expectation of Horvat is. Do you think that he's a 75-point player? Because if that's what you expected of him, that's you're just never going to get that.
Yeah, it's weird. I think a lot of it has to do with people who are trying to justify overpaying JT Miller because they don't want to see him leave, which, you know, I think we've made our feelings on the Miller trade thing clear, but it, to me, it doesn't make any sense that you need to overpay JT Miller because somehow Bo Horvat is less of a player now and not a captain material and, you know, is having a negative effect on the team if Miller isn't here. Like, that's just not factual. It's just made up, right? It's like when people are talking about, you know, Austin Matthews isn't having a good season. He's not an MVP candidate because he plays in Toronto. It's like, you're not basing that on fact. You're just using your personal bias and opinion and hatred towards the Maple Leafs to make that opinion. And I think that's what's happening with Horvat is that people like Miller more, which is fine, but they like Miller more. So they need to justify why he should be here and Horvat shouldn't be.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's kind of a made up story that has been fueling a lot of stuff. I don't see, and it's really been fan driven, which is the weird thing for me, because I figured fans would be just happy to have two good players on the team. I don't understand what the, you know, Miller versus Horvat thing is, and like why anyone is led to believe that these two guys can't coexist. I guess I don't know what the thing is. It's like you said, I think it's more salary cap constraints, and you know, obviously if Miller needs to get re-signed. And obviously people who are clamoring for Miller re-signing need to know that they need to make space for him to get re-signed. I guess that they think that Miller can replace Horvat for now, and that would be their approach. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I don't understand why people are saying the Canucks should get less good players. You know what I mean? Like it feels like that should be the opposite. Mm. But, you know, whatever. I mean, if people want to hate on Horvat, the guy's going to score somewhere between 25 and 30 goals this year on the second line. Like, you know, go ahead, I guess. I mean, Ryan Kessler's best year is the second line center. He scored 41 goals. I don't remember anybody ever talking about trading Kessler because he was a vocal leader and the Sedins weren't.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like you said, it's just, I don't know. Yeah, it's whatever. It's, I guess people will, people will say what they want to, I guess. Next thing I want to talk about, Nick Kiprios tweeted out a couple days ago. No, it was yesterday, I think, or a couple days ago, that the Canucks, you know, really want to still move money out this deadline. Rutherford seems really – Rutherford and Alvin, I guess. I always say Rutherford's doing everything. Alvin's the GM. Rutherford and Alvin looking to move money out here. And he linked Tyler Myers' name to maybe being a potential trade – at the deadline this year, and the Canucks reportedly already have his 10-team no trade list. Excuse me. This is not something that I expected, to be honest, with Myers' contract situation. You know, I'll be honest, I've actually been pretty satisfied with Myers' play for what Tyler Myers is this season. Obviously, he's not worth his contract, but I think he's been a serviceable piece on that right side. Does this development affect anything you've thought previously about the Canucks' long-term plans in terms of maybe moving guys like Miller and Garland or Besser or one of those guys necessarily having to move? Like if you can find a way to get out of a contract like Myers?
Yeah, I am surprised that, you know, the reports say that Myers could move at the trade deadline or before the offseason. Number one, I don't think that he's the Canucks don't really have very many good right side options. Myers is clearly their best one. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, he's actually played pretty good this year. Like, you know, he hasn't been his usual liability. Sure, he's had his moments, but overall, he's played pretty good.
Yep.
But yeah, I think long term, if you could move Myers, like he's clearly not a $6 million defenseman. If you could move Myers, that gives them so much more flexibility in terms of, you know, how you can build your roster. I think you can try to find a more defensive player, number one. Number two, you know, let's say you end up with a $6 million defenseman again, but as I mentioned, hopefully he's more defensive and not such a wild card in his own end. And number three, just, I feel like just moving Myers just is sort of like a reset for this team, right? Like he's one of the signature Jim Benning acquisitions, and just moving on from him and just sort of clearing the deck, I think is, you know, might not help the team as much on the ice, but it just shows that they're willing to try something new and go in a new direction.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a positive report in my opinion. If you can find a way to move Myers, I find it hard to believe that Myers gets moved at this deadline, to be honest. A couple of reasons. One, I don't see what kind of team that would even want to acquire Tyler Myers would have that sort of cap flexibility at the deadline to take on a freight that long for two more years. First of all, secondly, I think the Canucks management group and coaching staff think that they're in the playoff race here. And I think that, I don't think they're going to buy at the deadline, but I think that they will I think there's a chance they stand pat and don't even move Tyler Mott and just let this group see what they can do and maybe push for a playoff spot here. And I think, especially if they're in a playoff spot after the deadline, I think that this team probably just stays together as is. So it's a couple of reasons. And you're definitely not making the playoffs. It's weird to say this. You're probably not going to make the playoffs if you trade Tyler Myers in the middle of the season. I can't believe I'm saying this from 4 years ago when they signed that contract. But those are the two main things. But I think at the offseason, the draft, a Myers move would be in the club's best interest. And this, the Myers door opening leads me to think that maybe the contracts that we, the Jim Benning specials that have been signed that were pretty terrible. I think they still have bad contracts, but maybe there's enough interest around the league for some of these guys that you can still find a way to move some of these guys. Maybe you move one of them for like some expiring contracts, maybe attach a low round draft to get some of these guys out the door. I think that if the Canucks can maybe find an avenue to do that, like move out a lot of these dead weight contracts, that maybe there is a world where they end up keeping most of the top six players that they have and actually just using that cap flexibility to kind of retool and rebuild their defense and then going forward with the core they have right now.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully. Like, I always thought Myers was movable just because the last year of his contract, I think he only has a $1.5 million base salary.
Plus, he plays the premium position in the NHL.
Exactly. Plus, he's a righty. So the big key to me is going to be, can they move Jason Dickinson? Because anybody who's watched him play here, he's not – like, he's been healthy scratched, and the team has actually looked better with him in the press box. Like, he's not – whatever, for whatever reason, not a fit here. And I think he's at 2.65 for another 2 years. So,
yeah,
not insignificant. Like, if they can move Dickinson, I think that opens up a ton of options for them. Obviously, you'd like to move Pullman too, but I just don't realistically see anybody taking 3 years of Pullman unless you're taking like a, you know, another contract back, like unless it's a good Branson for Pearson type swap where the money's basically equal and the terms equal. And then in that case, you know, probably just keep Pullman anyways. So
yeah,
I don't know. I feel like Dickinson's the key. They have to move Dickinson if they can. It opens up so many options, both cap wise and roster wise.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think Myers, I've always thought from the beginning, has been movable. I think you could probably tell a story on a guy like Dickinson and get a team to bite on his contract. His cap number is not, it's big for what he is, but it's not, you know, it's not Ekman-Larsson, it's not Myers, it's not an Albatross, right? It's just a little bit bloated for a guy who maybe is a fourth liner instead of a third liner. But, you know, he was very effective in Dallas, and people in Dallas were actually disappointed to see him go. He was kind of a casualty of the expansion draft. So maybe you can be like, hey, you know what? He's not the right fit on our team, but we've seen him be a fit in X environment, and so have you. You know he's worth something. Maybe it's like, hey, we'll give you Dickinson for future considerations. sixth round draft pick, whatever it may be. If you can find a way to get out of the Dickinson contract in full, I think there might be some teams interested. Again, this is probably not, this is an off-season move for sure, but I think that that would be in the Canucks' best interest. That opens up a hell of a lot of cap space if you can find a way to buy Aaron Myers. I think the next guy I'd be looking at the offseason and move is Hamonic. $3 million for a right shot. Again, right shot D, plays the premium position. I think he's upped his value a lot with his play recently. He's playing a lot better. Of course, he's sorted out his whole vaccine situation as well. He's got that kind of old school playoff type. You know, he's a physical guy, stay at home, run double guy. He's got no teeth. You know, NHL GMs love that shit. So, you know, only one year contract. I think, you know, you can find a way to move out of Hamonic, Dickinson, and Myers, to be honest. I think realistically.
Wow, that's a big ask. But if possible, that would be huge.
It might be tough, but I think that I don't think that that's so based out of nowhere. Like, I think just kind of really reading the tea leaves, I don't think that is a crazy thing that could happen.
Maybe. I mean, I could see somebody like Arizona taking a player like Hamonic. He's got 1 year left. You know, I think New Jersey could potentially take Dickinson just because he is signed.
Like a Dickinson for Zaka swap or something like that, right?
Exactly, exactly.
We just get out of it at the end.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I think if you can move two of those three, that's probably a pretty good offseason. The problem with trying to move all three is that the whole league has no cap space.
Yeah.
And the teams that do have cap space, like Seattle, Arizona, Ottawa, the reason they have cap space is because they suck. So adding a player in his late 20s, early 30s doesn't really help them win in the future. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The only really solution to that situation, if you're going to a Seattle, is maybe attaching a draft pick to get rid of one of these contracts. But I think the Canucks need to seriously start thinking about that. I know the Canucks are very, very asset poor here, but most of the players that they have that are any good, they want to keep. They have no cap flexibility. So I think the Canucks either need to, you know, make some trades and because they need to get a young defenseman back. They need to find a way to get a young defenseman in this organization. If Rathbone is the answer, then maybe you can go Rathbone Hughes as a you know, two kind of puck moving guys, and then find four guys who can fill in roles with all the cap flexibility you're adding. And then that might be more of an aggressive strategy. Like, you know, you start moving picks out to get out of these shitty contracts. Then you keep your core players and, you know, count Garland and Miller in the core there. Keep those forwards together. Hopefully, Park Holzen and Hoglander take another step. They definitely haven't done enough that they'd be getting huge raises anytime soon. So hopefully those guys take a step forward. Forward group looks pretty nice then. You know, you still have a whole third line center. You have cap space. Maybe find a different version of Dickinson that fits your needs a little bit better. And then fill in your defense kind of on the cheap or find some kind of value players that, you know, people are kind of, you know, not super high on, but they can get the job done for you. And then see where you can get from there, because Jim Rutherford has built teams like that in the past. You know, where they have one really outstanding D-man and, you know, just five guys.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? And that goes back to our earlier conversation about fit and finding a player who's, you know, can play above their contract and above what you would expect on paper, right? You know, I think of, again, Luke Shen. I don't think Luke Shen should be a top four player on any team. But if he's in your bottom pair, fifth, sixth defenseman, like it clearly works with how Calgary, how Vancouver wants to play hockey. Yeah. So, you know, he signed for 800 grand next year. Like if you can get, you know, $2 million in value for $800,000, that's a good contract.
Yep. Yep, exactly. I mean, I do think it's something worth considering. I don't think that the Canucks are necessarily married to the idea of they have to trade one of these big name, you know, actually contributing members who are on kind of a larger ticket to get assets back. I think that this offseason will tell a lot to see how many of these bad contracts they can get out of. I think over-under is probably a 2.5. If you can get out of two of these guys, I think that opens up a lot of doors that people necessarily aren't looking at right at this minute.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's options, right? And
yeah,
biggest thing you need is just to have options going into the offseason, into next season. Figure out options that can you know, might not be ideal, but you can at least improve on the team from this year.
Yep, for sure. Last topic I want to touch on was Hoglander and Pod Colson. Their deployment has been sporadic, I guess you can say. There's been times when Boudreau looked like he's leaned on Pod Colson a lot. He's definitely not, in my opinion, definitely not a fan of Hoglander so far, or maybe he's trying to teach him some lessons, or I don't know. But, you know, last night, Hoglander played, you know, 743. Pod Colson played 1106. Hoglander pretty much was benched for the entire third period. A lot of people upset about the deployment of these two guys. What do you make of this with Boudreau? What do you think? What's going wrong for these two guys right now?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, I think number one, Hoglander didn't do himself any favors when he went 20 games between goals. That's number one. Number two, I don't think he's solid enough defensively. Like, you know, even was it the Montreal game? We saw that. No, it was the last game, Washington.
Yep.
That penalty literally behind Washington's goal line, like 199 feet from his own end.
Yep. Right, like, right after, you know, that fluky bounce. Yeah,
you just can't do that type of stuff, right? So, you know, I think the expectations for Hoglander are a little bit unfair because the Canucks were so bad last year and he didn't look like complete shit. People thought he was going to be better this year, but have to remember he's only still 20 years old. I think he turns 21 later this year. So 21 years old. And he was a second round pick for a reason, right? Like, he's not, he wasn't never expected to come into the NHL as, you know, first year in North America and score 17 goals or whatever he scored. So, you know, I just think a lot of it is the expectations that the market and the fan base has for the guy, which is unfortunate because I think, you know, I like the way he's being used by Boudreau. Obviously you want to see him get a bit more ice time, but I'm totally fine with Boudreau sitting him down and just saying, you know, listen, you can't do this stuff. You need to play the right way or you're not going to play at all. So, you know, in an ideal world, you'd want Hoglander playing a bit more, but like we talked about before, the Canucks are right in the playoff race and, you know, you don't want to lose a game that could potentially miss the playoffs because Hoglander does something stupid defensively.
Yeah. I mean, I'd agree with that. Like, Hoglander's defensive game has not been up to snuff, in my opinion. It's weird because when he's playing his best, I think that he is a hound on the puck and really he should be a good two-way player. But I don't know, maybe, you know, lack of production offensively, maybe getting a little bit trying to cheat on the offense, you know, typical stuff young players do. And I think that's kind of why Boudreau kind of always liked Pod Colson more. Pod Colson is an honest player. He plays, you know, Pod Colson would play defense at the detriment of his offensive production, you know, like he's on the right side of the puck more often than he's not. And he's a hard player, you know, he goes to the dirty areas and things like that. Hoglander, again, like, I think that these guys do need to play, but I think Hoglander scoring like at a 40-point clip in his first season was more of a mirage than people wanted to give him credit for. I don't think that – because a guy comes in his rookie season and he scores 40 points, like, wow, like, you know what, we have like maybe a top six player here, right? Like, oh, 40 points like in a rookie season, like, you know, it should be like 55, 60, you know, and he's in his prime here. And I just think that I don't think Hoglander is going to get to those kind of heights. I don't – Bo Horvat is a 55 to 60-point player in the NHL and, you know, he's a bona fide top six guy, and he was a ninth overall draft pick. You know, you typically don't find top six contributors outside the first round, outside the top 10, really. Like, you know, you find third liners and you know high-end third liners, usually. And Hoglander can be that, so I think we need to maybe kind of recalibrate our expectations of Hoglander and Hoglander specifically in this market.
Yeah, well, exactly, right? Like, you know, your Horvat comparison is good because I think when you look at Horvat and Hoglander, you see completely different levels of players. But the expectations for Hoglander are to be what Bo Horvat is. And when you line them up side by side, like, I think it's pretty obvious Hoglander is nowhere near as good as Horvat is right now.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe in 5 years that changes, but right now it's not the way it is. So I don't know. I just think the expectations for him are a little bit too high and people expect more than they should because of what he did last year, which was, you know, be one of the bright spots on honestly, one of the worst seasons in Canucks history.
Yep. And I can see the frustration too, because it's like a lot of times the guys playing over him is like maybe a Chiasson or a Dickinson where you're like, okay, these guys kind of suck.
Yep.
Right. But the thing is about those guys is that they're still professionals. They played in the NHL for a long time, and they know those kind of little things you need to do to stay on the right side of a coach, to kind of stay in the lineup. You know, they have their bad moments, but they're not so out, like, you know, Dickinson, you know, you might not be happy with this play, but if you go to the end of the night, you're not going to look back at Jason Dickinson. He's not going to be in the highlight reel getting burned because he, you know, missed a defensive assignment or was cheating for offense, and then the puck ended up in the back of the net. You're going to see that with Hoglander, though, and what is the coach going to see at the end of the night when you go through video and you see Hoglander cheating? Chase on Pearson, Dickinson, these guys aren't going to be doing those kind of things. They probably aren't going to score as much as them, but they don't have the high-end talent as them. But they do those little things that they notice that makes them stay in the lineup.
Well, exactly, right? And Hoglander isn't good enough to be bad defensively and still play. Like, I know this is an extreme example, but I think of Ovechkin.
Yep.
He was terrible defensively for, you know, probably still is horrible defensively. Yep. When you score 50 goals every year, nobody cares.
Yep.
Right? Like, when you score 16 goals every year, then you have a problem. And that's sort of where Hoglander finds himself.
Yep, yep, exactly. There's, you know, there's a very fine line between being Tobias Reeder and being Alex Ovechkin, is what I learned here.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, right? Like, you think of, you know, there's, say, 20 players a team times 32 teams. Like, let's just say roughly 700 players play in the NHL every year. That's it. 700 out of what? Millions of players that play hockey around the world. Like, you're already in the top 0.5% of hockey players in the world if you make it to the NHL. So the difference, yep, like you mentioned, between players on different teams and Hall of Famers and just sort of average players isn't really that much different.
Yep. Just those little things. It's really the little things. Like, there's obviously some guys blessed with this kind of elite talent, you know, like we talked about Besser, you know, used to top five release. Like, that's not something you're probably going to teach a guy when he gets to the NHL. Like, you know, you have it or you don't, you know. There's guys with those kind of talents. And, you know, if you're not blessed with one of those sort of talents, you need to find other ways to keep yourself effective and in the lineup, because you can't afford to be, you know, you're not going to be a guy who's necessarily leading your team's charge every single night.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I just find the expectations for Hoglander to be, you know, he's probably realistically a high-end third liner, kind of, yeah, a 6'7" guy. He's not a bona fide top six player. And
I'd say Hoglander is going to – if Hoglander ends up being like Tanner Pearson, but with like a little bit of a different skill set, I'd be like, that's probably more what his player career type is going to end up like. Probably like the sixth member of your top six, maybe probably a third liner on a cup team, chips in 20 goals, you know, 40 to 50 points every year, maybe like, you know, 35 to 40 points a year. And, you know, that's it. Solid in his own, solid in both ends of the ice, but, you know, maybe like a 16 to 20 goal scorer.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with having that player. You need those players in order to win, right? So yep, just because he was a top 40 pick and he's not going to be a 30 goal scorer, 70 point guy, doesn't mean he's a bad player. Right. So,
yep,
you know, I think Hoglander is coming along fine. Obviously, you'd like to see him play a bit more, but I feel like the expectations are so unrealistic for him that unless he's like, you know, Elias Pettersson every game, people are going to be disappointed.
Yep. That's fair for sure. Okay. Lab, before we wrap the show up here, Andy, obviously Canucks are taking on the Tampa Bay Lightning tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Rogers Arena, third game of the homestand here. Canucks sitting 3 points out of a playoff spot with one game in hand on the Vegas Golden Knights. Sitting here right now, are the Canucks going to make the playoffs?
I still say no.
Still say no.
The reason I say no, what's his name? Demko doesn't look 100% healthy. He had another maintenance day today. And as we've seen with Halak, you know, who knows what he's going to get. Yeah. He's either going to let in 5 goals in 10 minutes or he's going to make 40 saves and lose 2-0. So I just don't. Like, if Demko goes down or isn't 100% healthy, yeah, season post, it's still his first year being a full-time 60-game starter. I think he's starting to wear down, and unfortunately, the Canucks aren't good enough to just win with good or even mediocre goaltending. They need to have Vezina-level goaltending to win, yeah, so I don't think they make it.
That's fair. That's fair. And score prediction for tomorrow's game.
Ooh, score prediction. Well, I see the
back get some odds.
Playing tonight for Tampa. So that
yeah, means so we're getting Vasilevskiy.
So I'll say 4-2 for Tampa.
4-2 Tampa?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, all right. Oh, man, I don't know. I really thought the Canucks were going to be getting the backup. But, man, Vasilevskiy is on another planet. And like you said, Demko has looked a little shaky. But I don't know. Canucks are off a loss. Haven't lost two games in a row. I'm with 2-1 Vancouver.
Ooh, low scoring.
Low scoring. I think it's going to be battle of the goaltenders there. I think Canucks are still going to ride Demko. I'm not, I don't know. I feel like Demko's got that mental fortitude. I think even if he's a little bit banged up, I think he's going to fight through it here. And I think Tampa is not as fast a team as some team. The Canucks typically struggle more with those really, really fast teams. Tampa is not super fast, but they're not really slow. But I don't think their playing style really destroys the Canucks as badly as some other teams. I think of like the Leafs and Carolina and Florida, like those kind of teams just get all over the Canucks really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Got odds for you here. Canucks are plus 135 on the money line. Tampa Bay's minus 155. Over under set at 6. Anything you like there?
I guess I would take the under 6.
Yeah, me too.
As you know, as you just mentioned, two of the best goalies in the league. So I think offense could be a little bit harder to come by than some of the previous games. So I guess I'd take under 6 goals.
Yeah, that's pretty much the only thing that stands out for me. I don't know. Plus 135 doesn't seem like great enough odds on the Canucks for me to jump on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's Canucks are the underdog and Tampa is obviously a better team, but like you said, plus 135 doesn't really seem to be enough juice there.
Yeah. Obviously, those odds are courtesy of Bet99, the number one sports book in Canada. We do have a special link on our website. If you go to the Area 51 Sports website, you click under the betting tab. There'll be a link there. You can sign up there. It gives you an instant match up to $600 for first-time users, and it gives you access to boosted odds. So, you know, if you it'll show you certain prop bets have better odds. So, and if you're signing up in Vancouver, those games, they'll apply to Canucks games and stuff like that. So, you know, Elias Pettersson's, you know, plus 155 for a goal, anytime goal scorer, those odds can be bumped up to like 175. So check it out. But yeah, so go check him out there. Obviously Andy's part of the UFO show there. So he'll always tell you how to win some free money off Bet99. Isn't that right, Andy?
That's right. Yep. Check out the Area 51 Sports Network website. Use the link. They'll match your first deposit up to $600. UFO show every Thursday. If you listen this week, Adam gave out some good bets. We made some free money, and we discussed a little bit about the MLB offseason, where players are going to go, what we sort of think is going to happen. So check it out. It's always a good show.
Damn right it is. I gotta get on there with you one of these days. The Thursday record time is a little tough for me, but I'm gonna make it happen. I'm gonna get on there one day.
It's just work. You can blow it off.
Yeah, screw that, right?
That's right.
Podcast games where it's at.
What's the exactly
rolling
exactly
in here?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's we'll wrap this show up here. Thanks for listening to another week, everyone. Find us on all your major podcasting platforms: Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Wherever you get your podcasts, just look up Capspace Wins Cups. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Capspace Cups. We're super interactive, so check us out. If you don't listen from Apple iTunes, please go to Apple iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, because Ace is a 5-star man. He's not here to say it. It really helps with the show. Also, go check out all the other great content on the Area 51 Sports Network that we just mentioned: Point Shot Hockey, the Canucks Mafia, the Third Line Podcast, Terminal City FC, the UFO Show, Van Slam, and of course Shifts and Pucks, the newest podcast on the network. We have a bunch of fantastic writing on the website as well. It is your home for Vancouver sports content. That's all we have for this week. Talk to you all next week.
Vancouver selects from the University of Michigan, Quinn Hughes.
From Timrå,
Elias Peterson.
From Waterloo of the USHL, Brock Besser.
From the London Knights of the Canadian Hockey League, Bo Horvat.
To the Tampa Bay Lightning in exchange for JT Miller.
Thatcher Demko with an amazing 43-save performance says, let's play game six.
Gentlemen, please make some noise and welcome the 14th captain of your Vancouver Canucks, Bo Horvat.
To Patterson, here's Elias Peterson, and shoots, scores his first goal in the NHL.
Horvat again, what a move by Horvat, scores! Bo Horvat did that!
Look at the help, Peterson, shoots, scores! A hat-trick for Peterson!
And then makes it to himself, out the near side, he shoots, stopped by Quick. Rebound, they score! Brock Besser! JT Miller shoots, scores!